Welcome to the Mastering Therapy podcast with me, Dr. Natalie Stock, clinical psychologist. This is a show for psychologists, psychotherapists, and counselors who are looking to build on their therapy skills, increase confidence in working with clients, and be inspired by alternative models, tools, and ways of working. Join my guests and me as we learn from one another and aim to take insights and put them into action. Today's episode is a little bit different. I've got with me Matt Hussey, who is a BACP qualified therapist. He also has previously been a journalist, a photographer, content creator, but has just started an organisation called Together, which is aimed at creating spaces where people can come together and form quality relationships. Matt has a newsletter called The Brink, which has gone from 0 to 5,000 subscribers in just 8 weeks. And the reason for that is that Matt has an incredible gift at being able to synthesize the complexities of therapy, the difficulties, the vulnerabilities that being a therapist is, and put it into words. I'd highly recommend you go on LinkedIn and check him out. What do we talk about in today's episode? I could have spoken to Matt all day. We talk about the vulnerabilities of being a therapist, the power dynamics that exist between therapist and client, being in that position of not knowing. We talk about the difficulty when clients come to you wanting that expert position and wanting you to fix them and putting you on that pedestal. And what about that not knowing? What about when therapy is hard? What about when we're triggered by clients? So it's a raw, real, authentic, rich conversation. I hope you enjoy it. I am a newbie to LinkedIn. Didn't really know how it worked. I saw your posts, and the reason I saw them is, I guess, as a fellow therapist, it shows you things that it thinks you'll be interested in. But I was really struck by the authenticity, the profound authenticity and vulnerability as well.
I've tried loads of things. I used to share news stories. I used to share books that I liked. I used to do all the things that LinkedIn told you to do. And for some reason, I just gradually got more and more personal and gradually more and more about the work. And that just connected with people. It went from 670 subscribers to 5,000 in like 2 months.
I might just read a couple of the posts for people that haven't come across you, some of the headlines. So, I get rejected by my clients more times than I'd like to admit. I've been rejected in the very first moments of contact. They email me and I respond, but I never hear from them again. Another one is, my inner critic likes to tell me I'm a terrible therapist. He's always there following me around, waiting to jump in and tell me what I did wrong. Therapy is a lonely business. Once you're done with training, you're on your own. There's an elephant in my therapy room. It's there all the time. That elephant is called ambiguity. I like to call it the big I don't know. Go on, give them a wave. Sometimes clients piss me off. This is the one that came up on my feed. Some of them turn up late, some of them sit there, and some of them bend and push every rule and guideline I try to put in to create a consistent space for the work. And some clients I just don't like. Now, I think people are not used to hearing such vulnerability. I'm curious, Matt, whether you are as honest in your therapy sessions with people.
That's a great question. I think I'm going to be very therapeutic about it. It depends. Something that comes up a lot with the client work that I do is, who do they think you are in the both in the room, as in who are you supposed to be for them? And that can be constructed from what they think a therapist is, what they've seen on TV or a film, or it could be you are a replication of a relationship they have had with a parent, a teacher, some sort of authority figure. And where my clients get the most stuck is when I'm just almost an empty vessel, right? That's a very psychodynamic way of doing therapy, which was my first training was in psychodynamic therapy. And we had this brilliantly empty teacher who personified this, like, I am a vase, I am an empty vessel, please pour into me what you need to. I will just silently hold it. I hated that. I absolutely hated it, because for me, what it did is it made me feel like I was alone in the work. It made me feel like, yeah, I was sat opposite a person and they would occasionally respond to me. But ultimately, I had no idea whether what I said to them was good, bad, happy, sad, annoyed them, whatever. And that my first therapist, well, my first therapist kicked me out after two sessions, but my second therapist was this stoic nothingness in the room. And I lasted about 6 weeks and I was like, I can't do this anymore. And we had our exit interview and he said, why are you leaving? You're doing so well. You're projecting all your anger on me about your father and this is great. When were you going to tell me that? When were you going to share with me what it's like to be with me in this space? And in my final year of training, I had to do a sort of a presentation on my kind of therapeutic journey. And this was a key part of it, was I said, the image I always had of that therapist and what shapes my work now is I always felt like I'd go into therapy, I'd hand over these sort of psychic keys to the basement of me. He would unlock the door. I would go down the stairs into the darkness and fumble around in my own material. And I always felt he just stood at the top of the stairs watching the clock, waiting for me to finish. Mm. So for me in the work, like disclosure, I some of my clients know I've moved house. Some of my clients know roughly where I live. Some of my clients read my newsletters. But for me, disclosure is about the emotional response to what's happening with what they're saying, what they are feeling, what they are struggling with, what they are not saying or not revealing. I want the client to feel I'm in there with them. Yeah, we've gone down into that basement together and they're not alone. And so it's so important to take part in the work and to not just be this cool, distant observer. Because I think no one really knows how to be with a person who says nothing. But everyone knows how to be with somebody who says something.
Mm. Out of interest, did you feed this back to your therapist at the time? I think you said, when are you going to tell me that? Did you actually say that to him?
Yeah, I did. And he was like, well, that's not how this works. And I was in my late 20s at the time when I first started it. And I had a very kind of respectful relationship with authority. So I felt like I was put in my place. And I said, he said, well, that's not how this works. But on reflection, it was like, and I think this is why I see a lot of clients who come and see me who've had therapy before. There's a template that we create for what we think therapy is, and we're not allowed to test it or stretch it or poke it. And what I learned from that is, and what I encourage my clients to do is to prod this thing that we're doing, this relationship that we're creating, to be annoyed with it, to be frustrated, to, why aren't you telling me what to do? This is all welcome, because I think in my therapy journey for so long I didn't think I was allowed to do that, and I think it robbed me of a lot. And so for me, with my clients now, I'm like, let's get there early, get to the point where this is frustration, let's get to the point where what I said was wrong, let's get to the point where you feel I let you down or I rejected you, because I think there is the best work, is when a client can go, oh, I get to contribute to what this is like, not just about out there and back then, but in here. I get to shape this in here. This is where I get to exert some sort of control. I get to create a relationship rather than I feel like I sit with you and talk and that doesn't feel like much of a relationship. I get to create what this feels like. I think for me that's become so important in the work that I do.
Yeah, and that's only possible when the person in front of you sees you as a human and not just an expert or as their rescuer or as their guru. I think the fact that you were able to bring that up with a therapist, I don't know if that was because you're on training or I guess part of your personality, but I'm always conscious of the power dynamics within the therapy setting. We have to be so conscious of that, because otherwise we are not going to pick up on those cues in terms of how maybe somebody is feeling or experiencing therapy. And it is a position of power when somebody is paying you for your service and your time. I guess they do come with their expectation. And it's really important that we respect that and acknowledge, I guess, what their template is and do a bit of digging to try and work that out. And also to not abuse that position, because I think it's really easy to do, even if we're not mindful of that power imbalance that is always going to exist.
Yeah. And I couldn't agree more. I'm doing my supervisor training and the sort of modality is phenomenological, which is a nonsense word, but I think it captures a lot of what we're saying. Phenomenology, if I correct, is the idea of observing what's happening now. And it's to be able to explore what's happening now. And so the type of training that I'm going through at the moment is all about power and privilege and really grounding the work of being a supervisor and I think being a therapist in. We have the therapy that we have learned, the tools that we've techniques we have learned is to understand they come from a place and a type of people and a type of privilege that comes from the therapy rooms of Central Europe at the turn of the 20th century. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we have to be willing to acknowledge that they are from a place and a time and they were pushed through a lens of a person. Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, these wealthy white men. And when it comes to working with clients and with other therapists, I do some teaching of other therapists, is to really honor where they are coming from and what I may or may not have to say might not align. And that thing about power that you identified is to be able to recognize when power is at play. I think some people get very scared about power and they try to be powerless. And I think that's not the point either. I think the point is that a lot of our clients want to feel led. And a really lovely phrase I've learned recently that I think speaks this idea of power with clients is the difference between overseeing a client in a kind of like hierarchical way, in the sense of you have a position where you can see a lot and it's about not about applying it, it's about bringing it into the work and helping clients see it too, but not to enforce, not to boundaries they come up again. It's about going, yes, there are boundaries and yes, there are certain things you can and can't do in this work. But so much is in between those boundaries. So much is in between those boundaries. And I think power and privilege and authority and what the client wants you to be, I have clients who elevate me almost way too far. They're always an idealization. And it's up to us as therapists to try and bring that back down or to explore it or to go, why am I all the way up here? Do I need to be up here? Do you need to put me there to help you? Can I be alongside you and still be useful to you? So much of the work sits in those spaces.
I don't know if you've read much on family therapy, but this is really making me think of the systemic ideas around. So in family therapy, you've got like first order practice and second order practice. And the first is the more authoritarian, hierarchical, I am the expert, I am seeing and I'm intervening. And the second position is the not knowing. It's like the knowing and not knowing is how it's traditionally termed. And I think we evolve, although I'm not a family therapist. I think as we evolve in our work, we kind of carve out our own path in terms of where we feel comfortable. And with experience and with age, I think it does change. I wonder when you've worn lots of different hats in your life. You've been a journalist, a photographer. I know you're also now a startup founder. Whether you observe how you operate in therapy has changed just even in the last, say, 5 years.
Absolutely. When I started this journey, I had this really strong desire to be right. And what I mean by that is right by the clients, right in my understanding of theory, right in the practices of therapy. It was this sort of life raft that I relied upon really heavily in the early stages of this work. This, am I notes correct? Am I doing therapy right? Am I asking the right questions? Am I listening? Am I actively listening? All those sorts of things. I had a real desperation, I'd say, to adhere to this toolkit that was given to me. But what I found, even in my training, because I stretched my training out for quite a long time for financial reasons, just life reasons, I felt that there were certain points where I felt like the work was too much and I needed to step away from it. So I stretched this all out. But each time I came back, what I found is I was more interested in prodding and being more curious about what is it that I need in this work, this certainty, this absolutism in this work. Why was I so desperate for it? And it was because of this, I don't know. I was terrified of I don't know. I was terrified of 20 different interpretations of a client turning up 5 minutes late. I wanted it to be, this is what they were doing. This is why they did it. And they were trying to show me this. And, wonderful, I understand. Let's move on. I think what's happened to me as my career has gone is, A, you don't get that. You almost never get that. You never get a client articulating to you, I'm misbehaving or acting out for these reasons, or I said that because of this, or you never get that certainty. And also, the more you learn, the more you read. If there's one thing that therapists are very good at, it's disagreeing with each other about what's happening in the world. And that used to really bother me. And that's why I used to double down on certain theories over others. And I used to be really critical of CBT and the kind of shorter therapy work. But what I've learned recently is like, it's all trying to do the same thing, right? It's all trying to help a person feel understood. It's all trying to have a person feel someone cares. And I think for me, how you get to care, that how you get to that point where someone feels like they care, how you get to the point where a client can feel they have reinterpreted a part of their story. This is going to bother all the people that have taught me over the years. It doesn't really matter how you get there, the rightness of it, because I've had clients who didn't want to be therapized in any kind of way, didn't want interpretation, didn't want that rightness from me. They just wanted me to sit there and they told me about their job and how good they were at their job. And at the same time, how terrible they were in their relationships. And it was this sort of thing of like, I'm not getting to do therapy here. I just have to sit here and listen to them. And I think that for me was one of my earliest clients. I had him for 2 years. And one of the greatest teachers I ever had was the sense of rightness, the sense of I know what I'm doing, the sense of this is the process, the treatment plan. I know some people like to use treatment plan. They get thrown out the window quickly if a client chooses to. And if that happens, what happens then? You've got to keep turning up. How are you going to be?
Have you ever been curious about using AI to do your note-taking after your therapy sessions? The admin juggle is real. Using AI to transcribe my notes has quite literally changed my practice forever.
I'm going to be running a 70-minute webinar that you can join live and you can have access to after and watch as many times as you would like. I'm running this on Friday, the 25th of April, 2025. So put the date in your diary.
This is a step-by-step guide on how to use Heidi Health, the note-taking AI software for therapists. If you're curious about how it works, including concerns around consent and GDPR, or if you're already using it and want to ensure that you're maximizing the features, then this webinar is for you. Join me and sign up at masteringtherapy.com or click the link in the show notes. What is coming up for me as I'm hearing you talk is we're trained so differently, I think, as clinical psychologists. We are taught to, you work to the evidence base, you work in a time-limited way. With the NHS, there is a process. You don't turn up to a session. There's no chat about that. You just get an email that says, sorry, we missed you. You got one more chance. You don't turn up again. You're out. There's not the resource to be curious about that. And I would say, I mean, I've only been doing private practice for a year now, but there's a real difference in the work that I can do with somebody that is, say, self-funding and is up for this journey 2 years, a year, versus even insurance clients that have been given 6 sessions or 10, 15 sessions. And I think I'm more comfortable almost in the, okay, what are we doing? Right, we can't go there because we don't have the time. So let's ring fence that. So I'm not going to go down that cul-de-sac. We haven't got time for a cul-de-sac. We're just on the motorway. And I am really going on this journey of curiosity, I think, and of almost unlearning. I mean, I don't want to unlearn it all, because ultimately, for some people, what they need is, I'm struggling in work. I need to get back into work. How can you help me in the next 2 months to get me to that place? I don't want to go and talk about the anger I've got towards my mother. So I feel comfortable in that. And as I'm hearing you talk, I'm thinking this, it is a very different way of working, but a really beautiful way. And again, I think it comes down to the needs of the individual, because for some people, maybe they wouldn't be able to tolerate that. They're at a place in life where they need that like quick fix, as it were. And for others, actually, maybe that's just going to be a bandage. And in order to make long-lasting changes, they're going to have to climb the mountain, to use that metaphor. So yeah, it's really helping me reflect on how we're trained as psychologists. I mean, there was a whole thing in my year around evidence-based practice versus practice-based evidence. And if we don't ever base the work that we do on what we see in the therapy room, we base it on what we know works. And I was trained in CBT. I don't tend to use CBT so much anymore. I use far more compassion-focused therapy and ACT. But even ACT is fairly tool-based. And I like, people do like that. What can I do to manage my anxiety? And they want the tools to manage it. But I think more and more, I realise that really understanding the function of it and understanding this is very a normal human emotion and not to be scared by it, to understanding brings revelation. And I think that is really powerful for people, when they can not feel so scared about something. This is making me think of one of your posts that you did on the inner critic. And you spoke about your inner critic being there, telling you you're a terrible therapist. But actually, it is trying to protect you in some way. And those, the ways it tries to go about doing that are actually quite helpful. It's maybe not doing it in a helpful way, but it's trying to protect you from missing something or doing harm to clients. And so we have to give space to being able to understand, as opposed to just treating, which is the very medicalized model.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on the medical model, but I think that they will come from a place of there's a purpose for them too, and there's a need for them too, for exactly the reasons you just described, Natalie. Huge parts of this work is based upon the idea of, can somebody recognize that they are in distress, find somebody who has an expert label, leaving that quite loose for them to define what that is, and can they feel the expert be an expert with them? That is so important. It's the ability to show a client that you can handle and hold what it is they brought to. And not only handle and hold, but also build up on it, or give them tools, or give them something that can help them leave that room for the how many sessions we have and go, I did something about it. I had this horrible thing in my life. I went and found somebody. That somebody gave me something. I feel better for it. And it's that agency that's so important, right? A client has to be able to feel like they can find someone who can help them and feel they have been helped. And I think that's something that sits underneath all of this work. I think it's the client intent. And I think you touched upon a really important point that in my work in private practice, it tends to be motivated individuals seeking a very specific therapeutic experience. But the majority of mental health touch points are often not as framed as that way. They are often people who are referred, they're often people told they have to go, they're often people who are doing it because a partner said so, or some other reason, right, where they get pushed through a kind of funnel and they need to feel something positive, need to feel something out of it. And who are we to argue what's right or wrong there? Are we to argue whether one's better or worse? And I think it's being able to hold all of this at the same time, as you said about your journey, Natalie, about starting with evidence-based work and then moving into a fuzzier space, right? A less defined space. Obviously, all the things you know are still there, but you're able to hold it more lightly, to hold the theory, to hold the tools, but also at the same time as holding all those things, is to hold the person and to feel what they need.
Yeah, and I think the reason that we don't do that, especially early on in our training, is the fear, exactly what you said earlier, is the fear of getting it wrong. Yeah. And I am realizing I probably get more wrong now. Like, the fear has materialized. I get more wrong now than I got wrong when I was on training. But I think the work that I'm doing, I am really proud of, because there's far more depth. And I'm learning what my style is. I'm learning how to not just be, like, in a way, the version of just an empty vase. Well, the equivalent of that, we could say, is these AI chatbots that do CBT. You know, you're going to get a variation of a similar thing. You could go to one CBT therapist and go to another and it be very, very similar. And maybe for some that is necessary and needed, but I want therapy to be a really personal journey. I don't want to be the same person for person A as person D. And I think it is the skill of a therapist to be able to meet that need and bring a different part of myself. I know I've got one client that she needs a real soft, compassionate, soft approach. And I would say I'm quite a directive, straight talking, shoot from the hip kind of person. Now, if I was to be fully that with her, I have to tread carefully. It wouldn't go well. And I don't think that's me being inauthentic. I think that's me just accessing a different part of myself. Because I'm also compassionate and kind and warm, but it's just about knowing when to play certain hands, and I'm getting more comfortable with that rather than seeing that as, oh, I'm not really being me and having to be the same for everybody. I think it is about being flexible and adapting.
Yeah. And if you don't mind me asking you a question, that
of course.
Has that process of learning how to adjust, to climb up and down that kind of therapist ladder, has that been carried into your personal life? Have you found that the person you are privately with friends and family and colleagues, has that evolved and changed as a result of you evolving and changing in the world?
Oh, yes, I think so. I guess I'm wondering whether it's a direct result of the work or whether that's a result of maturity and life experience. We've got an ongoing situation in our family, and a way that I would have handled it 10 years ago, I look back now and I think, oh gosh, I would not respond like that now. And that probably is an element of me learning and growing, and also just being okay with not rushing in with guns blazing with all my tools to kind of say what I see and try and fix it. I am far more comfortable sitting back, which I think is also a direct parallel in therapy and in how I am with people. I find it far easier now to sit back and observe than rather the pressure to be right and to come up with the solutions. So it's a bit of a chicken and an egg. I'm not sure which came first, but definitely I can see those. I can see that shift. What about you?
Yeah, very, very, very similar answer. I think by the time I'd got to qualifying, I think I'd had to have gone on this journey myself on my own in my own material. I think I came from a sort of shame-based learning background, which is something I've learned a lot recently. And so what that is the way you were taught to learn or taught not to learn, for me, was about being shamed when I got something wrong. You know, like, why did you get that wrong? That's terrible. Like, that's, how can you not know how to do this thing?
Yeah.
And my childhood was blessed with those sort of moments. And so what happened is when I was in relationships all the way through my life, I would, whenever I'd hear what I perceive as criticism, I would immediately bring back that kind of child response of becoming very defensive, withdrawing, defending the way I did it, that I need to be right, to argue was to win, all those sorts of things all came bubbling up. I had to really get to go through all that in my own therapy to move to a much more, okay, this is, when I hear what you say, this is what I hear. and I'm aware that's why here, but I'm also trying to hold these other bits too. I'm trying to take them more of a balanced thing, not to rush in, not to judge, not to criticize, and to be aware that, yeah, maybe when a client gives me feedback, that bumps into my stuff, but it also is their stuff too. And there's the understanding lies somewhere between the middle.
Mm.
So I think for me, I'd had to do that work on my own first. And then as the therapy training came into view and sort of percolated through all that, it kind of joined together a bit, and it kind of allowing yourself to be taught by your clients, I think, you know, wasn't in my training much, but it's something. And my supervisor, you know, I said to my supervisor, I keep rushing in. I keep rushing to, with this one client, I was, to analyze and to prescribe and to see that I could, to show them I can do it, show them I can fix them. And she said, well, what would happen if you didn't? And I said, I have a small crisis privately, but I think something different might happen. I just said, well, maybe that's what needs to happen, is you need to allow space for something different to take place here, for you not to be that version of you that you think they need you to be, but to be someone else. I couldn't have done that 5 years ago, but now I feel more able and willing to go, there are other ways of being with people, both therapeutically and interpersonally.
Can I ask you, Matt, if you had not had therapy yourself, what do you think the difference would be? If you had done your training, but you hadn't been in therapy yourself, how different would you be, do you think? How much has your own therapy journey influenced your practice?
I don't think I would feel comfortable calling myself a therapist, if I'm honest, if I hadn't done it. I was in private therapy, my own therapy, for 12 years, on and off. And I went through like this huge series of chapters in the work where, for the therapist that I settled with, number three, wonderful Denise, I spent the first 3 years performing what I thought was therapy. Because I didn't trust her. I didn't think she could hold my material. I didn't think I could be uncontained. And so I did that for 3 years, and it wasn't until she pointed it out, I was like, oh. But then it took another 3 years to trust her. And then it took me another 3 years to kind of get into my own material in a way that I had never done before. And I had felt rejected by her. I felt that she didn't care about me. I felt that I didn't trust her. I felt that this was all just a process and there wasn't really a relationship here. Had I not gone and done all of that in my own time and basically made my own mistakes and done all that stuff, I don't think I would be able to recognize it in clients. I don't think I'd be able to go, I know what that feels like. I think we have to have been to the outer edges of our own material and sat in the darkest depths of our own material, learn to live in it before we can really go and help someone else do it. I think when I did my training, a lot of colleagues who hadn't done as much of their own work, what you found is that when we did material, it really, really got to them. And I had colleagues who walked out of training sessions, like colleagues who refused to do certain exercises because it was too revealing. If that's in a practice situation, that's in a room full of colleagues who are all doing the same work you're doing. If you can't do it there, what happens if a client does it?
Yeah. The reason I ask is that it's not a requirement of clinical psychology training. I don't know if you were aware of that, but I think there's a real gap for psychologists, certainly in the UK, where it's, I guess, encouraged, but it's not a requirement in the same way it is in counselling training.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so my training programme actually offered, I think there was £1,000 allocated to your own training for your own therapy. But I don't know how many people use that, but it's certainly not a requirement. And when you think, especially as clinical psychologists in the NHS, you are some of the most senior therapists, and so you see the most complex clients, and it just really strikes me how like big that gap is. And there's a lot of talk around being the expert. I know people have different reactions to that. And certainly therapists do tend to be quite self-deprecating and feel like imposters a lot of the time. But I remember one of our tutors saying, "No, you are trained to doctoral level standard. You are the expert. You need to own that. You need to be that." And I get what he's saying, but in many ways, I agree with you. If you have not gone to the outer edges of yourself, if you've not done the work yourself, one, how can we expect the client to do that? And two, we don't really know what that experience is like. And there's so much that you learn about yourself and about therapy through when it goes right, when it goes wrong, in being in the other seat. So thank you for your reflections on that, because if people are listening and you haven't had therapy and you are a therapist, please go and get therapy.
Please do. Please do.
Do yourself a favor.
Yeah, because nothing but good things come out of it. Yeah, you'll probably look at some really bad stuff, right? And you'll be very upset by it. But with time and patience, that lesson and those scary corners, or how I used to describe it in my own therapy, was I used to have this vision of shelves above my head with boxes labeled like skull and crossbones, still not open, you know, never, and to not touch them ever. But this work will bring clients to you who will want to open them, those boxes in themselves, and by being with them when they're doing it, there may be a sense that you need to open your boxes too. Definitely not with the client there and then, but if you haven't done that, if you have all these boxes that say toxic, do not open, bad relationship here, how are you ever going to help someone go through that process? And I think to echo your point, Natalie, I think there is a need for us to feel there are people who know more about this thing. But I think what I've learned over time is to come from a place of, I am not an expert in you. You are. What it feels like to be you, what it feels like to hold those memories, what it feels like to have had those relationships, what it feels like to be sat in front of me, you are the expert. And to give them that agency over their own story, I think is so important.
Well, Matt, I feel like I could talk to you all day. Thank you so, so much for coming on. But before you go, you have just started a charity, an organisation, a startup. What is it? Do you mind just sharing a bit about it? Because I think something that you are going after, other than your incredible authenticity and enabling lots of other therapists to feel seen and heard on LinkedIn and through your newsletter, is you're trying to reshape how mental health services work. Do you mind just sharing a bit about that, and people, if they would like, can go and have a look?
Sure, and thank you for the opportunity for promoting it. So there's a paradox in this profession of ours, in mental health. Never before has there been so much access, so much awareness, so much language known and spoken by so many people about mental health. But when you look at the numbers of people suffering from mental health, they keep going up every year. Antidepressant use goes up every year. Diagnosis goes up every year. General contentment goes down every year. And that says that there's something going on that we're not looking at. We're not looking at mental health in the right way. We have learned to talk about it, and we have learned to create services. We've learned to get people access to it. We've done all these amazing things, but there was always something missing. For me, what was missing was that interpersonal community gathering thing that we have done for 2 million years as a species, but we have never quite put our finger on in the modern age as why it's so important. And where I found sort of solace in this is a very famous study called the Harvard Grant Study. You may be familiar. It's the longest study of people ever conducted. It started in 1936 at Harvard University. They took 200 undergraduate men and they asked themselves a very simple question: what were the things about their lives that were the biggest indicators of a healthy, happy life? They interviewed them every 2 to 3 years till they died. JFK was one of the first group. It's still going today. They're interviewing the children and grandchildren of those 200. There's now a separate study that looks exclusively at women. There's a separate study that looks at working class children in inner city areas, all asking the same question. And the thing they learned over and over again was it was the quality of your relationships that was the single biggest predictor of your life, the quality of your life. And what they found is that at age 50, when the applicants were 50, the biggest indicator of how healthy they would be at 80 was how strong their relationships were, how many people they knew, how many people they felt known by, how enriched their lives were by their relationships. So together, the company that I have started is taking those two things, the paradox of mental health and yet people feel worse, and the very, very clear evidence that it's your relationships that keep you alive, that keep you happy and physically happy and ward off disease. And it's all, and there's a brilliant book called The Triumphs of Experience by the former director of the program. I recommend you read it. And so what my mission is to bring those two worlds together, to bring community gathering, community experiences, community events with the world of mental health and the skills and the tools that we have all developed in our fields, and to bring them together. Bring them together in spaces online and in person, and to give people the chance to access services that don't cost them an arm and a leg, to be able to gather with other people, to be able to hear from other people, and to be able to feel what it feels like to be in a community of people who care about you or interested in you. And I started this weird experiment where I invited mental health professionals to join the WhatsApp, and it's called Together Thursdays. And every Thursday, I ask them a question about them and their practice, and everyone just talks about it. And it's been going for a few weeks. There's over 100 people in there. And the question starts on a Thursday. And last week, people were talking to each other. I was moving house during all this. People were talking to each other for 3 days, video, audio, written word, just listening to each other, supporting each other. And these people were from everywhere, from Britain, France, America, Canada, Australia, India, Pakistan, Kenya, lots of places in Africa. And what was so beautiful and wonderful about it was they were just interested in each other. Your experience sounds so interesting. Or my experience sounds the same as yours. And let me tell you about that. And they connected to that. That's what together is.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And it's wonderful to watch it growing and gathering momentum online, on LinkedIn. So I guess watch this space, because who knows where that's going to head. If people want to find out more about you, Matt, how do they do that?
Yeah, so obviously LinkedIn is where we connected. So I'm on there, but I'm also, I have a newsletter called The Brink, which is where I write more broadly about interesting corners of mental health. I've written about the psychopaths of TikTok. I've written about the history of the phrase toxic masculinity. All these sort of areas that sit in and evolve around our work, I like to write about those. So you can find me there. I'm also on Instagram. I do lots of video content now. Yeah.
And when are you finishing your supervisor training?
In the spring.
Okay.
Yeah. So knee-deep in it at the moment. And I will be looking for people to work with me.
Yeah.
So if you're interested, reach out.
Wonderful. Thank you for your time. So much to think about. And yeah, really, again, honest and vulnerable conversation. So yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Mastering Therapy. All of the resources mentioned are available in the show notes. If you're interested in getting more information on what's been covered this season, you can sign up to our mailing list or visit the website masteringtherapy.com. If you've listened to this and you've thought of someone you think would be great to interview on the podcast, submit a recommendation on the website. I'd love to hear from you. The Mastering Therapy podcast and the information provided by me and my guests is solely intended for qualified professionals.